and a Knife. That's the band. Don't Hurt My Little Sister. That's the song that you're missing because A Mansion for the Rat wasn't on this evening on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and on the stream at WBAI.org, also known as ORG. 1 a.m., Tuesday into Wednesday, time for this edition, a brand new program still in the works of the dustbin of history. And here we go. This band, by the way, is the Telescope Bowmen, who do the opening. An unknown band. Even though I tracked down one of the members of the band, he has no idea what the source of the audio clips in this music was either. Thought it was a radio drama. That's the best I can tell you. Hoppy's Dream.
There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schmid is brilliant, and Arpo Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. That's a tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Welcome in to another edition of the Dustbin of History. Something different for you tonight. A Gene Shepherd TV soundtrack will be our lost Gene Shepherd tonight. TV show called The Talkers from 19-something, 1974. And a couple of fragments of Gene Shepherd programs to fill out the time. We have a almost full hour presentation to begin the program. Someone posted this to YouTube and shared it online, and it's a rather rare program, an attempt at stereo radio drama called the GE Stereo Theater. They produced 4 episodes, and more than that, I can't tell you, except the first one is Agnes Moorehead starring in Henry James' Turn of the Screw, and that's what we have for you tonight. Sadly, though, it was not recorded or preserved in stereo. Someone tacked on a little music at the beginning and the end that is in stereo. That's all the stereo we got on the GE Stereo Theater for you. But let's see, do we even have an air date for you? Let me look that up quickly. Hang on. Okay, well, the second episode, Billy Budd, that they promoted at the end of the show, was broadcast on March 27th, 1963, so this must be a few weeks before that. Gee, I thought it was even later, but no. 1963, Agnes Moorehead in The Turn of the Screw. And we'll be back later with some Gene Shepherd rarities, program fragments, and a TV soundtrack. Did I mention, this is the Dustbin of History, and I'm your curator and janitor, Max Schmied. Welcome. Oh yeah, and it's all coming to you over WBAI New York.
Moorehead. And I'm particularly excited over the drama you will hear presently. The Turn of the Screw by Henry James, in which I play the role of the governess. Of the many characters he created, none is more challenging to an actress than the unnamed governess in The Turn of the Screw. In the end, we know little about her, but we know that we have been in the presence of evil. We've been harrowed and terrified. And because the focus of the story is 2 children, because it is at them that the threat is directed, the effect is given, in James's own words, another turn of the screw.
This is General Electric's stereo drama.
I was somewhat anxious as I walked up Harley Street. It was, I recall, a pleasant day, warm and sunny. A hansom cab went by, and somewhere near, possibly in Cavendish Square, a hurdy-gurdy played. I rang, and a maid in a white cap and apron opened the door. Good morning.
I know, miss. You're expected. This way, please.
She led me to the study, and there he was. How can I describe him when I've never seen anyone even remotely like him before? He was tall, handsome, dressed in the height of fashion, and still very manly.
Well, this is an agreeable surprise.
I beg your pardon?
I was not referring to your presence, but shall we say to your appearance?
Oh, thank you, sir.
Our correspondence has already told me almost everything I wish to know about you. But I still felt it might be useful for us to meet.
I felt the same way about it.
Come in, come in.
Thank you.
Now, about details. Bly, the house, is in Essex. It has its own grounds and is quite adequately staffed. In addition to Mrs. Gross, the housekeeper, there's a cook, a housemaid, a groom, and a gardener. While nominally you will be the governess, actually, you will be in complete charge.
Who are my charges to be? How many children are there?
Two. But Miles is away at school and will be your responsibility only during his holidays. However, he's coming home within a day or so, which is why the matter is urgent.
And how old are they?
Well, there you have me. As you know, they are my brother's children. He and his wife are dead. And being unmarried myself, well, Flora is 8. Or is she 10? And Miles must be about 14?
I see. At any rate, not infants.
No, they're quite mature. And quite intelligent. At least, so the previous young lady informed me.
The previous...
Well, there was, until recently, another young lady taking care of them.
Oh.
It was because she left that I was forced to send Miles away to school.
I see.
Now, there is one condition to all this. If you accept the responsibility of this post, you must accept full responsibility for it. If any problems come up, you must deal with them yourself. You must never trouble me, never write to me either to complain or to ask for advice.
That doesn't frighten me, the responsibility. But, of course, you will come down occasionally to see how the children are doing.
No. Not unless the circumstances are extraordinary.
I assume since you were their only relative, well, I will take the post, and I will do the best I can. I went down by coach the next day. Luke, the groom, met me with a fly and took me to the house. It was even lovelier than I had expected. There were vast sweeps of lawn, a lake. And when the carriage stopped, there, waiting at the door, were a pleasant-looking middle-aged woman and one of the most beautiful children I have ever seen.
Good afternoon, miss. Welcome to Bly.
Thank you. You must be Mrs. Gross, and this must be Flora.
I'm most happy to meet you, miss.
And I to meet you, Flora. Oh, but she's lovely, charming.
She is that, miss, and as good as she's pretty. Well, shall I show you to your room?
No, let Flora do it. After all, if we're to be friends, we should become acquainted.
Oh, may I? Because I hope we're going to be friends.
She took my hand, warm and trusting from the very beginning, led me into the house and up the stairs. Then, opening a door...
This is your room. I hope it suits.
Oh, it does. Admirably. And your room, Flora, where's yours?
Just across the hall there.
Oh, that must be very lonesome for you all alone in there. How would you like to move in here with me?
Oh, could I? I should love that. I do get lonesome, especially with Miles away. But Miss Jessel liked to be by herself.
Well, I'm not Miss Jessel. We'll have your things moved in after tea. Now, whose are these other rooms?
That's Miles, next to mine. And that's Mother's and Father's. It's kept locked now.
Oh.
And that's Uncle's, when he comes down here.
And up the stairs there?
Oh, there's nothing up there. Just the tower room.
And whose is that? Mrs. Gross?
No. She's in the other wing, in back. Tower room is no one's. Not now.
But I should like to see it. I want to see everything. Come up there with me.
But I... Very well.
But it's quite a nice room. Smaller than mine, but the view is even better. Why are you standing there, my dear?
Because I don't like to go in there.
Why?
Because it was his room. Quince.
Quince?
He was Uncle's valet. He stayed here with us for a while. And then he went away. He's gone now.
I see. All right, Flora. We'll go down now. Miles arrived late the next afternoon. Flora and I were in my room, our room, when the fly got to the house. We went down together, but by that time Miles had come in and was standing in the hall with Mrs. Gross. He looked up at me and I looked down at him. And, well, I must confess that when I saw him then for the first time, my pulse quickened. There was something about him that reminded me of someone else. Yes. His uncle. Something in the way he stood there. His assurance.
Miles. Oh, Miles. I am glad to see you.
Hello, Flora.
This is the young master, miss.
It's very nice to meet you, ma'am.
It's nice to meet you, Miles. I trust you had a good journey.
Very. The coachman let me sit in the box with him part of the way.
Oh.
But I'm afraid I'm rather dusty. Would you excuse me if I went up to wash?
Of course.
I'll go up with you. At least, may I?
Yes, Flora. I'll see you both later. Well.
Yes, miss. He is a fine, handsome boy. And he does resemble his uncle.
Yes, he does.
Oh, it's good to have him home again. Oh, by the way, miss, Luke brought the post bag also, and there was this letter in it for you.
Oh, thank you, Mrs. Gross.
From the master, isn't it? Their uncle.
Yes. Enclosing a letter from the headmaster at Miles' school. He never even opened it. Wants me to read it, answer it, if it requires an answer.
Yes, that's like the master. A most pleasant gentleman, but he doesn't like to be troubled.
What's this? They've sent the boy home from school.
Well, haven't they sent them all home? I mean...
For the holidays, yes, but they say Miles can't come back. They won't take him back under any circumstances.
But why?
They don't say. They only say they won't have him, that they have a responsibility to the other boys. Oh, as if he were a bad influence on them or a danger to them.
Master Miles...
The most ridiculous thing I ever heard of. I'll admit I don't really know the boy.
But I do, miss. I've known him since he was born. And to suspect him
of
anything...
Well, he shan't go back there. I wouldn't send him back even if they wanted him. We'll find another school for him after the holidays.
Oh, I'm glad you feel that way about it, miss. Not that I can say I've never known him to do anything wrong, anything at all.
Then he has.
Well, not done anything really bad. Wicked enough to have him dismissed from school.
This badness of his, I don't want to know what it was, but did it have anything to do with you, or did it involve someone else? Miss Jessel, say?
Miss Jessel? How did you know about her?
Well, I know there was someone here before me, another governess. Their uncle told me that. And Flora told me her name.
Oh, yes.
What was she like, Miss Jessel?
Oh, she was young and pretty, miss. She was a lady. At least she was supposed to be. And I thought she was at first, but afterwards... Well, one mustn't speak ill of someone who's gone for good.
You mean she's dead?
Yes, miss.
I didn't know that. She didn't die here, did she?
Oh, no, miss. She went away. And then afterwards we heard that she died. But if Flora told you about her, did she also tell you about...
Who? Or what?
Oh, it doesn't matter. Will you excuse me, miss? I must see cook about dinner.
The next day went quickly. Spending time with Flora alone had been pleasant, but having Miles there, too, was an enchantment. Just before tea time, I left them reading and went for a walk around the grounds by myself. A flight of rooks flew overhead, and in the distance the village bells rang for vespers. I was thinking, I remember, of him, the children's uncle. Of what it would be like if he should suddenly appear around a turn of the path and smile at me. When all at once, all sounds stopped. Yes, all, as if everything about me had been struck dead. I turned, startled, looked back at the house. And there in the tower room was a man looking at me, watching me. We stared at each other for a moment. He was some distance off, but I felt that he was a stranger, that I didn't know him. Or did I? I couldn't be sure. But one thing I was sure, he was evil as something from the pit. Then he must have stepped backward, away from the window, for he disappeared. Mastering myself, telling myself to be reasonable, I hurried back to the house.
Good afternoon, Miss. Is anything wrong?
No. At least, I don't know. Tell me, Mrs. Gross, has anyone just arrived? Some unexpected guest?
Why, no.
You're sure?
But of course I'm sure.
Then, Mrs. Gross, tell me, is there anything I should know that I don't know yet? Anyone here, living here, perhaps secretly?
What? Oh, no, miss, nothing like that. Whatever made you think it?
Because when I was outside just now, I saw someone up in the tower room. And it wasn't anyone I knew, Luke or the gardener or anyone.
Someone? You mean a gentleman?
No, not a gentleman. His clothes were quite good. I noticed his waistcoat, but decidedly not a gentleman. That's why I wondered whether... Couldn't it have been Quint?
Quint? How do you know about Quint?
Flora told me. He had had the tower room. And so couldn't he have... He have come back here to get something he'd forgotten, or...
No, miss, no. How could he when... Miss, tell me, did he... The man you saw... Did he have red hair?
I'm not sure. Yes. Yes, I am sure he did have. He did.
Oh, the Lord have mercy on me. But it can't be. It's impossible. It was getting dark and you were far away. You only thought, imagined.
But I didn't. I tell you, I'm sure.
No, miss, it's... Please, let's not talk of it anymore.
Turning, she hurried away, leaving me there, and leaving me with a deep and gnawing dread. Late the next afternoon, we were in the schoolroom, for that is what we made of Flora's old room when she moved into my room with me. Flora was practicing her penmanship. She had done several pages without a scratch or blot, and Miles was reading. At least I thought he was reading. I'd given him the book myself. When I looked up and found that he was looking at me, studying me with a strange look in his eyes.
I've done another page, miss. And I think this is even better than the others.
Oh, it is, Flora. It's completely admirable. Have you finished, Miles?
Yes, I have, ma'am.
And did you like it?
Very much. Would you like to hear it? When to the sessions of sweet, silent thought, I summon up remembrance of things past. I sigh the lack of many a thing I sought, and with old woes, new wail my dear time's waste. Then can I drown an eye, unused to flow, for precious friends hid in death's stateless night, and weep afresh love's long since cancelled woe, and moan the expense of many a vanished sight.
You mean you got that by heart after just one reading?
No, ma'am. I must confess to you that I read it once or twice before at school. I think one of the reasons they didn't like me so much there was because I like poetry. But it's true, I do have a good memory.
Good. I think it's miraculous. Well, that's enough for today. What do you say to a walk?
Oh, yes, let's. Can we go down to the lake?
Of course, my dear. Wherever you like. We went down together. But when we got to the door, I realized I had forgotten my gloves. I had left them in the dining room after lunch. I sent the children on and went in to get them. It was a gray day and the light was dim, but there was enough of it to see the gloves on a chair. And at the same time, I saw something else. Him. The man I'd seen in the tar room looking in through the window at me. Again we stared at each other. And this time I was close enough to him to see that his hair was red and long and combed with a swirl over his low forehead. But most of all, I could see his eyes, dark and glittering and seeming to look deep into me and see things that were... He looked at me, then past me, as if searching for someone or something else. And finally, he stepped back. Where I got the courage, I don't know. But I hurried to the nearby French door, opened it, and stepped outside. And he was gone. I had not been a moment. I had barely taken my eyes from him, and still he was gone. The terrace, the lawns were empty with a great emptiness. I turned back to the dining room, looking in through the window as he had done, and at that moment, Mrs. Gross came in from the hall.
Oh, my. Oh, miss, you frightened me.
Well, I didn't mean to. I just saw him again. He was outside there, looking in through the windows. Quint.
Quint? But that's impossible. I told you it was impossible.
Why is it impossible?
Because he's dead.
Dead?
Yes. He came down with the master last year. They were both here for a while. Then the master left, and Quint stayed on. And while he was here, he was in charge.
And afterwards?
Well, I never liked him. Never. And after, when the master was gone, he was worse. Much worse. There were things missing.
He stole?
Oh, he did worse than that, but I could do nothing about it.
But you still haven't told me how he died.
Well, it was after Miss Jessel had gone. He had taken to leaving here at night. Sometimes he went to the village, to the pub. Sometimes he went no one knows where. One winter night, he did not come back. In the morning, they found him, a gash on his forehead, lying dead at the foot of the hill.
But what had happened to him?
Well, they said that he'd fallen and hit his head, but it was a savage blow, and there were many who did not like him.
You mean that it was... that it could have been murder?
I don't know, miss.
And to think that he had charge of them, the children. That Miss Jessel permitted...
I know.
But she's dead, too.
Oh, if it had been me, I should have died of fright.
Well, I was frightened, too. Even though I didn't know then.
No.
That he was dead. But now, Mrs. Gross, awful, terrifying as that is, there is something even worse.
Oh, what do you mean? How can there be?
There can be. There is. You see, he was looking for someone or something. And now it's clear. He came here for one of them. The children.
We have heard Act One of The Turn of the Screw. Tonight you are participating in a true premiere in entertainment. This evening's performance of The Turn of the Screw is the first dramatic presentation prepared especially for network broadcast via stereophonic FM radio. The General Electric Company is gratified to bring you this historic program. And General Electric is proud of its role in helping to create still another milestone in radio broadcasting. It was on June 1st, 1961, that GE's research in FM stereo made possible the first commercial FM stereo broadcast on WGFM, the General Electric station in Schenectady, New York. Today, there are some 177 stations from coast to coast broadcasting in this exciting new medium. Musical programming in FM stereo was a critical and popular success from the beginning. And now the depth and dimension of stereo comes to drama. Our performers, our writers, directors, and producers are all most enthusiastic about their roles in this new venture, an enthusiasm reflected in the performance you're hearing this evening. The QXR network is also enthusiastic about the potential of stereo drama and wishes to thank General Electric for making possible this exciting addition to its programming service. All of us concerned feel that there is enormous potential for dramatic offerings in stereophonic FM radio, not only as entertainment per se, but as an important new cultural force in the community. The Turn of the Screw is the first in a series of stereo dramas. On March 27th, we present Billy Budd, starring Peter Ustinov. On April 17th, The Fall of the House of Usher with Joseph Cotten. And on May 15th, Cyril Richard will star in Visit to a Small Planet. Naturally, these stereo dramas are an experiment. And so, we welcome your comments, your criticism, your suggestions. Write to General Electric Stereo Drama in care of this station. This is the QXR Network.
This is WDTM, Detroit's Taliesin station at 106.7 FM.
As the house lights dim, we return to that strange house in Essex, to the Turn of the Screw, and to Agnes Moorhead as the governess.
I wonder how I could face the children after that. But I managed, after all I had to. Somehow I got through that night, and of course the next day was not quite so difficult. But the next night, I'm not sure what woke me. An owl? One of the village dogs? But when I woke, Flora was standing next to my bed, her eyes large and dark, her face pale in the moonlight.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to wake you.
You didn't, Flora. Is anything wrong?
Oh, no. I just wanted to make sure you were still here.
But of course I'm still here. Where would I go?
I don't know. But sometimes, at night, she would go someplace.
She?
Miss Jessel.
Oh. Well, how do you know? You weren't here in the same room with her.
No. But sometimes I would hear her door and then footsteps.
Going where?
I don't know. I would just hear them and...
Did you hear any now? Is that what woke you?
Oh, no, no. Where are you going?
To see.
Oh, no, please.
I must. Now get back into bed. I won't be a moment. I went out into the hall and stood there for a moment listening. But there was nothing. No sound, either above or below. The door of Miles's room was closed, and on an impulse I went over, opened it quietly, and it was empty. Miles was not in his bed. I went in to one of the windows and looked out. At first I saw nothing, just the park, the lake glimmering in the distance. Then something moved. And, yes, there he was, Miles, standing at the bottom of the terrace and looking up. Not at the window of his room, but up higher than that, at the tower room above. He started up the terrace towards the house, and I sat down on the bed, waiting.
Oh, it's you.
Yes. Are your feet wet?
I don't think so.
But they must be. Here's a towel. Dry them and then get back into bed.
Yes, ma'am.
Miles, where were you?
Nowhere. Just outside.
But why? Why did you go outside?
I just wanted to.
But why did you want to? There must have been a reason.
Yes, there was. Do you think I'm good?
Of course I think you're good. Very good.
That's what I thought. And I have the feeling you don't like people who are too good.
What? Whatever do you mean?
The other day you talked about a boy you once knew. The boy who sang in the choir.
You mean at the parsonage? Oh, but he wasn't a boy. At least, he was my age.
Yes, I know. But I had a feeling that though you liked him, you would have liked him even more if he had not been quite so good. So I did what I did. Went out to show you I could be quite bad.
Is it that important to you? That I should like you?
Can't you see that it is?
Yes. But don't you know that I do like you? Like you very much. In fact... Oh, Miles. Miles, my dear boy.
I hoped you'd do that. Kiss me.
Now tell me the truth. Is that really why you went out? Are you sure it wasn't to meet someone? The next day, both children were pale, subdued, and I was somewhat listless myself. So in the afternoon, I took them out to get some air. We went down to the lake. There was a boat there, and Miles insisted on taking the oars, rowing us over to the other side. Are you sure it's not too much for you?
My dear.
Miles is quite strong. Stronger than he looks.
Thank you, Flora.
I smiled at them both, but particularly at him. Rowing had given him back his color. And since he was playing the gentleman, he looked somewhat older and more like someone else. We landed, and I took myself into the shade to read while they played at the water's edge. I was tired and sleepy, and I was starting to nod when...
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I disturbing you?
No, Miles, of course not.
I thought if you were tired of reading, perhaps we could play something.
I'd be delighted. What would you like to play?
What about the Crimean War?
Well, that sounds interesting. How would we go about it?
I'm not sure yet, but this is a splendid place for it. The lake could be the Sea of Azov, and this the Crimea. I'll be Lord Raglan, and you can be Florence Nightingale.
And Flora?
We'll think of something for her. But first we have to find a place for the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the charge of the Light Brigade. Shall we try in here?
Very well.
Mind the branches.
I started to follow him in amongst the trees. But before I did, I glanced back, looking for Flora. She was still there at the edge of the lake. She had found a flat piece of wood with a hole in it, was fitting a stick into it to make a boat. Then my eyes went past her, and I froze, my heart skipping a beat. For on the far side of the lake watching her was a woman I had never seen before, but whom I knew. She was young, about my age, but looked older than her years. She was dressed all in black, and there was an awful, dreadful stillness about her as she stood there watching Flora. My eyes came back to Flora. She was still busy, intent on the boat that she was making. But suddenly I was aware of the worst horror of all. She, Flora, knew who or what was standing there on the other side of the lake waiting for her. And it wasn't only Flora. They both knew. That was why Miles was trying to involve me in his game, to draw me farther away, leave Flora alone with her. I sat out on the terrace after tea watching them. The two of them with new eyes. They were walking up and down on the lawn below, Miles with a book in one hand, his other arm around Flora. The door opened behind me, and Mrs. Gross came out.
You've been very quiet ever since you came back, Miss. I didn't want to ask before while they were here, but...
No. Well, I have reason to be quiet. Something else happened this afternoon while we were down at the lake.
Something else? Not...
No, not Quint again. This time, it was his companion.
Miss Jessel? No, no, Miss, no, it couldn't.
I know, and still it was. But that's not the worst of it. They knew. The children.
They knew?
That they're about Quint and that woman. And what's even more shattering, they like the idea. This afternoon, Miles tried to draw me away into the woods so that Flora could be alone with her.
But how can you be sure of that?
Because I am sure as I am that... You think that Miles is reading to Flora now? He's not. He has a book in his hand, yes. But they're talking horrors.
Of them?
Of them. Of how they can get away from us and to them.
But why? Why should they want to?
Partly because it's a game to outwit us. Partly because of the attraction of evil. The evil that Quint and she taught them in days gone by. But mostly because they don't know what it would mean if they should go to them.
And what do you think it would mean?
But don't you know?
Yes. Their end. The end for both of them. But the other two, Quint and she... Why should they want them?
Are they evil? Were they?
Yes, Quint at least.
Isn't that the function of evil? To destroy good?
Yes. Yes. But, oh, Miss, we can't let it happen. We must save them.
How?
Get them away from here. Send them away to him.
Their uncle? Well, you know him better than I. But when I saw him, if there was one thing he was firm about, it was that he was not to be troubled.
Yes, it's true, he does hate to be troubled. And if we should send them there to Harley Street... All right. If we can't send them to him, then we must get him to come down here. Oh, will you write him and get him to come here?
It won't be an easy letter to write. I'll do it. At least try to do it tonight. I sent Flora into Miles's room after supper to play while I sat in our room with pen in hand and paper before me. Had I said it was not an easy letter to write, it was impossible. All I could do was impress him very carefully with our great need, and so I wrote, calling on all my skill and subtlety. I had barely done one paragraph when... Yes? Come in. It was the children, both dressed very strangely. Miles was wearing a long, brightly colored robe, probably a man's dressing gown with a turban on his head. And Flora was swathed in long, flowing scarves. He carried a toy drum in one hand, a candlestick in the other, and she had a pair of cymbals. They both looked outlandish, but incredibly beautiful, like a pair of exotic angels.
Are we disturbing you?
Of course not. Why are you dressed that way?
They're our costumes.
We thought somehow you seemed remote, unhappy. And so we thought you might like it if we put on a little play for you.
Well, that's a charming idea. I should love it. What are you going to do?
Well, it would spoil it to tell you. You'll see. In Xanadu did Kubla Khan... A stately pleasure dome decree, whereout the sacred river ran, through caverns measureless to man, down to a sunless sea. So twice 5 miles of fertile ground, with walls and towers were girdled round. There were gardens bright with sinuous rills, where blossomed many an incense-bearing tree. And here were forests ancient as the hills, enfolding sunny spots of greenery. Oh, that deep romantic chasm which slanted down the green hill athwart a cedarn cover. A savage place, as holy and enchanted as e'er... as e'er...
Why are you stopping? Why don't you go on?
I'm sorry. I'm afraid I've forgotten the next few lines.
Forgotten? How could you forget?
I just have. I don't know the poem too well.
Don't you? A savage place, as holy and enchanted, as e'er beneath a waning moon was haunted, by woman wailing for her demon lover? Why would you not say that?
I told you, I forgot.
You with your incredible memory? That was not the reason. You had another one, deeper and darker. What do you know of haunted places, and of women wailing for their lovers, their demon lovers?
Nothing.
You're lying, Miles. You did it. Put on this whole performance. Just to...
Please, I don't know how or why we've upset you, but it's clear we have. I'm sorry. We'd better go. Come, Flora.
They went, leaving me in a turmoil. Had I said they looked like angels? A pair of fiends, rather. It took me till after midnight to finish the letter to their uncle. A storm was brewing, the wind wailing around the house. My candle guttered as I went down the stairs and put the letter on the hall table for Luke to post. Then I went back up the stairs again. And when I reached the top, I saw a gleam of light under Miles's door. He was still up. I hesitated, then went in.
Hello.
Why aren't you asleep, Miles?
Well, you might want to come in. You want to talk.
About what?
I don't know. Whatever you like.
Oh. Well, perhaps I do owe you an apology for the way I acted. What I said before. I shouldn't have said you were lying.
I'd never lie to you. Never. There are other things I might do, but I'd never lie. Do you believe me?
Yes, Miles. I do, and I apologize. But as you recognized yourself, I was upset. I have been for some time. I tell you, all I want to do is help you.
Help me how?
To free yourself, you and Flora, too, from this coil of evil. I've watched it tightening around you, and... Oh, Miles... Miles, my dear, if you'd only help me now. Help me to save you both. Candle! What happened to the candle?
It was just the wind. It blew out.
It wasn't the wind. It was... Wait a minute. Flora!
Where are you going?
Back to my room. To her. I threw the door open. The room was dark. But by the fitful flashes of lightning... Low down on the horizon, I could see Flora sitting bolt upright in bed. And I could also see something else. She was there, too. She stood by the open window, her black dress blending with the dark sky outside, but her pallid face gleaming like a corpulent. She didn't move. She stood there, looking at me steadily.
Oh, he startled me.
I'm sure I did. You thought he could keep me there, didn't you?
He?
Miles. Don't you think I see it now? That was all a plot. He with his candle lit to get me to come into his room, hoping to keep me there, talking, while you and
don't,
she...
Please don't. Can't you see that you're frightening Flora?
I frighten either of you.
But you are frightening me. You are. You are.
All right, let's have it out in the open then. Look over there near the window and tell me what you see.
Why, nothing.
Nothing? Are you pretending that you don't see her, Miss Jessel?
Miss Jessel?
But she's... She's dead.
Heaven have mercy on me. What is it? What's going on?
Oh, Mrs. Cook! Take me away from here! Take me away from her!
From me?
Yes, from you. From you! I never want to see you again!
The next morning, the whole house was strangely hushed. Miles kept to his room, and I had breakfast all by myself. I had just finished when...
Good morning, miss.
Good morning. How's Flora?
Not well, I fear.
You mean she's sick? Really sick?
It seems so. She tossed and turned all night, barely slept. And when she did, she kept crying out. And this morning, she's all flushed and feverish. You know, I was thinking perhaps we should call the doctor.
Well, if you wish. But he will not be able to treat what truly ails her. There is only one person who could do that.
Her uncle.
Yes.
Oh, but heaven only knows how long it will take him to get here. You've not even written to him yet, and here...
Of course I have. I wrote last night, put the letter on the hall table. Luke must have taken it, posted first thing this morning.
But... I was down here before Luke came over from the stable. There was no letter on the hall table.
But I put it there myself last night. Miles.
Miles?
He was the only one who could have... would have taken it.
Oh, no, miss. He'd never do that.
But he did. I know he did.
But if he did... Oh, miss, what are we going to do?
There's only one thing to do. Time is getting short. That fiendish pair, Quint and that woman, are getting bolder. I think I can fight them off. Keep them away from at least one of the children. But I cannot guard them both. You must take Flora away.
To London?
Yes, to her uncle. They left late in the afternoon. I heard the fly pull up to the door. Heard them get in while Luke brought out their baggage. Then I heard them leave. I was in my room at the time. I stayed there, hoping that Miles would come in so that we could talk. But he didn't, and I didn't see him again until that evening.
We're alone.
Well, almost alone.
Yes. There are the others. Somehow there are always the others.
Are there?
You know that there are. It sounds as if we shall have another storm.
Yes. Shall we talk now?
Yes.
Then tell me, Miles. Did you take that letter I wrote to your uncle?
Yes. Yes, I did.
You admit it?
Of course I admit it.
Is that what you did at school? Why they won't have you back?
You mean because I took things? Stole? Oh, no. How could you think that?
Then why did they dismiss you?
I imagine it was because of things I said to some of the other boys.
What sort of things?
I'd rather not tell you. They were things I'd heard... learned that none of the other boys seemed to know.
And where did you learn them?
From someone.
From Quint?
Yes, from Quint.
And were they very terrible things?
They did not seem so at the time, but I suppose they must have been.
I see. I think I can guess what they were. And what did you do with the letter?
I burned it.
Why?
May I hold your hand while I tell you that?
My hand? Well, we can do better than that. Come here, and I'll hold you in my arms.
Yes. This is better.
Then tell me.
I did it because... in spite of what happened, what you did, I still like you.
What I did?
Yes. Pretending you'd seen Miss Jessel. Because I knew if you wrote Uncle about it, he'd send you away. And...
Pretending? You think I was pretending?
You mean you weren't?
Of course not. She was there. I saw her. But that's not important. What is important is why you did it. That you did it for me. And... Oh!
What is it? Why are you trembling?
Because... Look there.
No. No, I can't. Is it she again?
No. No, it's not she. It's Quint.
Quint? No, it can't be. Where?
Just outside there. Looking in. Turn around and you'll see.
No, I can't. I won't. Let go of me.
I shan't let you go. You shan't go to him and he shan't come to you in spite of everything. Stay where you are.
Just as you say, madam.
Yes, as I say, and I say you shan't have him.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm sure, because no matter what you did to him, tried to do to him, he's still good. Destroying that letter for the reason he did proved it. And no matter who or what you are.
And who am I?
Not mention your name, but I know it.
Yes, you know it. And my voice, too. When did you last hear it?
Your voice?
You heard it in London, in Harley Street. And it's been sounding in your ears ever since.
What are you saying?
That it's his voice that you're hearing. The master's. Of whom were you thinking when you saw me for the first time? Of him. And whose clothes was I wearing? His. Because there was something you wanted.
No! No, you shan't confuse or frighten me. You exist.
Oh, yes, I exist. I have existed ever since a certain thought was born in the darkness of your mind.
Is that true? Is that true? You're lying. You're only trying to torture and torment me because you've lost.
Have I?
Yes. Yes, Flora's gone and neither you nor that wicked woman can reach her. As for Miles, he's mine now. I've saved him.
Have you?
Yes. Yes. Now go. I order you to go.
Yes, madam. Anything you say.
He went, fading slowly into the darkness. I continued to hold Miles tightly in my arms. He was strangely still. I shook him. Miles? Miles? I said. But he didn't answer, and his eyes remained closed. We were alone. And his little heart, dispossessed, had stopped. Would never beat again.
And now this is George Edwards hoping that you've enjoyed our dramatic premiere tonight, and that you'll be joining us on the 27th of this month for Billy Budd, starring Peter Ustinov. Meanwhile, next Wednesday, the wit and whimsy of Victor Borge will again be with us on the General Electric Music Theater. This is the QXR Network.
The General Electric Stereo Drama. Number one, I suspect. I also suspect it was March 14th, 1963, 2 weeks before the next presentation, Billy Budd, that they announced at the end of the program. Turn of the Screw. Here in the dustbin of history on WBAI New York, I'm your curator and janitor, Max Schmid. And it's time to turn to Lost Gene Shepherd. And we have actually three segments for you. The first being a television soundtrack from a series on WOR television in 1974. The show specifically August 30th, 1974. The Talkers, and I believe a variety of WOR hosts rotated hosting the program. Well, this one has Gene Shepard. It's the only known example of this that I'm aware of. And it was sent along to us by our good pal, Pete Delaney, who I used to know as Ranger Pete. Now I guess he's just plain old Pete. But thank you, Pete. And I've recently discovered that I have, oh, dozens, if not hundreds, of Pete's shows on the drive that I carry around with me, so chances are good we'll hear more from Pete's stuff in the coming future. Here's The Talkers from August 30th, 1974, featuring Gene Shepard, television soundtrack. Coming your way in the dustbin of history, WBAI New York.
This is WPIX-TV, Channel 11 in New York City.
Oh, it's what it's all about, you know. I mean, love and cheering. And late at night, when you're sitting there. You know, we're all New Yorkers. Are you all New Yorkers here this time? Man, that's a special breed. I mean, my hobby, by the way, it's a great hobby. 2 a.m. when I go home, I live down in the village. I sneak up the steps of my apartment. I'm on a second floor. It's dark. It's 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. I carefully put the key in the lock. Because timing, as you know, in life is everything. How many of you have missed every streetcar in your life? Of course, most people don't even know there is a streetcar, so it's all right. So I stick that key in the lock and wait 2 beats. 1, 2. I grab the doorknob, carefully pull the door open, and the room is pitch black. And I wait 1 more beat. 1. Put my hand on a light switch. I wait, then I flick it on. Millions of cockroaches. I start stabbing them. That's my hobby. I kill cockroaches every night. Some nights I get 600-700. In fact, I got a 7.5-pound competition cockroach mounted, hanging on my wall. It's beautiful. So we're all New Yorkers in it together. Here it is, the Labor Day weekend. Within hours, there's going to be nothing but bumper-to-bumper tin all the way to Montauk. 17 hours out to the beach, 12 hours back. They'll have 4 minutes on the sand. Oh, it's New York. But there's a lot of things that are great about living in New York. You know one of the great things about New York? This is the only city in the world where you can watch all-night television. No other place. I love it. I love those used car commercials that come out at 2 a.m. The guy says, you ain't got no credit nowhere else? You just give us a call, we'll give you a car in the morning. You know, you come down there, you know, and I sit there at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm watching these black and white grainy films. You wonder where the devil they got them. They look like they were filmed underwater. There's Chester Morris is always flying this airplane through the clouds. I'm sitting there waiting for my favorite television character. He comes on at 3:05. Oh no, the Preparation H man. I love him. He comes on and he says, Preparation H. He points right out of the camera at you and he says, I'm sitting there at 3 a.m. with my cockroaches running around, you know? And he says, Preparation H is medically proved and guaranteed to relieve itching. That's 3 a.m, see? With the kind of mind I got, I keep thinking, what itch? Is it the big itch that all of us feel? Deep down inside of us, that life must be more than just hoping that the next Howard Johnson will have 28 flavors. Life's got to be more than just a Big Mac at the McDonald's. Yeah, ain't it the right man? I love that Big Mac. I love it when it's running down your arms, dripping into your sleeve. Oh, God. That, you see them on the commercial, you know. And that's why I think most of us in America today love commercials better than shows. Because life looks so great in commercials. And you notice everybody that goes into the McDonald's on the commercials, everybody at the McDonald's is smiling and laughing and are dancing around. Trick the muscles, hit the pepper, you know. They never show 45 people waiting in line for 2.5 hours for a quarter pounder with cheese. Because that... That's right. Medium rare. Oh, honey, no way. That's a connoisseur. People that eat a medium rare, I mean, you probably even read. Well, I'll tell you, you know, that's all part of life, you know, and it's like me, you know, I love to watch that lady plumber come on. Josephine, the lady plumber, of course. She comes out there, and I tell you the reason I love to watch her, because she comes out, and she only does one job, apparently, as a plumber. She only has the problem of tea stains in the sink. Now, that's rich. Do you agree? To call a plumber because you got a tea stain in the sink? Hold on. Don't quit pointing. It's all right. We know. It's commercial. Okay. Every time I have ever called a plumber, friends, it's been more than a tea stain in the sink. It's been knee-deep. We'll be right back. It's time for a commercial. How about it, gang? Let's hear it.
I'm Tony Wilson. My two brothers and myself own Wilson's House of Suede and Leather. I'd like to tell you about our half-off sale. Sales are not unusual. At Wilson's House of Suede, we cut coats individually for ladies and men. 38 colors, wrap dye. Styles like these, and many more, are now half off. I'm sure you'll be pleased with our styling, or my name isn't Wilson.
Or mine.
Or mine.
Located 18 West 57th Street, right off 5th Avenue.
People who don't know us think Banco Popular is just another small business in New York. As a matter of fact, many of our customers are small and medium-sized businesses. Actually, Banco Popular is a very big bank. Bigger than 99% of all the banks in the USA, but small enough to serve you personally. With business and personal loans, checking and saving accounts, Banco Popular, a full-service bank, right on the money.
Egg, the best natural source of complete protein. Everybody loves them. People love them. Dogs love them. Up until now, it wasn't easy for a dog to get an egg for himself. But now there's new Gainsburgers with egg. The moist, meaty taste dogs love, plus a quarter of a real egg in a burger. So why not give your dog a taste he'll love and all the goodness of real egg? Give him new Gainsburgers with egg.
What's that? Well, now, wait, why don't you save that that question? All right, okay, come on. Let's all hear it now for Jerry the JGE Man. Come on. Jerry, he's interrupted more movies. A little air conditioner to keep cool, you know? All right, listen, gang. For those of you that are watching us out there, we're just sitting here for a half an hour and just sort of, you know, cutting up a watermelon, as my friend John Neville says. How many of you know John? Great guy. And if you're out there, out in the darkness, here's the phone number. Now, wait, I'm going to have to look over here to get it. It's 682-7114. Give us a call here. And if you have a question about my work, probably some of you have heard me. You might have seen me in Playboy. I do a lot of... I haven't done the center fold out yet. Oh, God, I'd love to let it all hang out once, you know? Ooh, you got it. And we've got a call. Okay, we've got a call on line one. Now, let's hear what the caller wants. Let's hear your question.
The question is, if you put your tongue on a frozen telephone pole, will it stick to it?
Yeah, does it really stick?
That's the intelligent kind of question we want. Let's hear it. I understand a questioner said that if you put your tongue on a frozen metal telephone pole, would it stick, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, I have a friend that is still just this side of Nome, Alaska. He's been there for 4.5 years with his tongue on a telegraph pole, who did not believe that it worked.
But it's good to be a believer.
Yeah, it'll work. As a matter of fact, you can peel your tongue like a grape, kid. What? Might I add, this is typical slob humor. He said, hey, did I tell him, Aki? Human cold sore. All right. Okay, now how about a call from line five?
Yes, hello?
Yeah.
Hi, Gene Shepard?
Yes.
Yes, I have a message. Boo-ha-ha, boo-ha-ha.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you. All right. Let's see if we can get an intelligent questioner, and if we can't, we're going to cut the telephone calls. What do you say? All right, line three. No, I'll do it. I'm mean. Yeah?
If you woke up tomorrow morning mayor of New York City, and by the way, I support your candidacy, what would your first action be to clean up this mess if you were mayor?
Clean up this mess?
Yeah, if you were mayor, what would you do to save the city?
Friend, I love this mess. I'm a guy that just naturally loves messes. In fact, I'll tell you this, if you don't like a mess, you shouldn't live in New York. I mean, this is the only town where one of the major art forms is the pothole. Thank you, kid. Anybody else? Anybody here in this crowd? How about in the studio? How about a question?
Is Gene your real name?
Is Gene, who asked that? He says, is Gene my real name? Yes, Gene is my real name. On my birth certificate, on my driver's license. I know it's hard to believe, kid, but then again, we can't believe your name is Aki either. Yeah, my name is Gene, and that has been one of the worst things that ever happened to me in my life, you know, because, you know, it's a French name, J-E-A-N. Well, I was in second grade. I had this teacher named Miss Shields at the Warren G. Harding School. How would you like to be going to the Warren G. Harding School, named after the worst president in history? That is up to now. I mean, can you imagine right now out in Ohio, some poor little kid's going to the Richard Milhouse Nixon School? He doesn't change the name. I mean, you know, they're out there in the front now changing names. Well, that's the way fame is these days. Anyway, my name was J-E-A-N, see? So, I, you know, this was a terrible problem that everybody, you know, I had to fight my way through school, you know, with that name. And when I got into high school, we were already, you know, when you're a freshman, they assign you to your classes. My first class in high school was girls swimming. I arrived. All these chicks are sitting around there, you know, in their tank suits, and I walk in. Well, I'll tell you, it was the beginning of a high school career that was notably undistinguished. So, my name is J-E-A-N. It was my father's name. And I learned very early in life that you got to be careful what you name a kid. I mean, you know, if you name a 7-foot-9-inch lineman Sylvia. All right, anybody else got a question here? Yeah.
What was the most frustrating day in your life?
One of the most frustrating days in my life. Well, that was a good question. I'll never forget the time that I went out with Schwartz, and I was 14 years old. Now, when you're 14, it's like you're made out of cellophane. You think you know everything. And actually, you're totally ignorant. I mean, you don't know it. You just think you're swinging at buttons, you know, that say things like, save the world on you, you know. Yeah. Oh, no, that was a later crowd. Wrote Flick Lives over to urinals. No. That was another world. And I, you know, I'm standing in the you know, high school there. We're just freshmen in high school. And Schwartz asked me, he says, how'd you like to have a blind date? He says, I know you don't usually go on blind dates. And I said, well, yeah, I'd love to go on a blind, you know, just for you, Schwartz. And we go out on this blind date. We're riding in the bus. I'll never forget the girl. I'd never seen this chick before. I arrived at her house, and, you know, when you get a blind date, you expect this dog, right? You should have seen what showed up. She was unbelievable. Shepherd has hit the jackpot. We're sitting in a bus, see? And Schwartz is sitting up ahead of me, see? It's a double date. And that's why I went out with him. So he says that this girl that he was going with would not go unless she had a double date. And Schwartz is having a ball up there talking. So I start to talk to this girl that I'm out with, see? And I'm saying things like, boy, my old man's a real slob. You should see how he forgot to change the grease in the car and cracked the block. Boy, the White Sox are really looking good this year. Yeah. You know, I'm pulling all my great conversational ploys, and she is saying nothing. She's sitting there with her cook like this. I get nothing out of her. And I all of a sudden see above, you know, in the buses, they got these car cards. There's this ad for Lifebuoy soap. It says, do you offend? It suddenly hit me. The cold light of truth came down right from the front of that bus. I was the blind date. They were being nice to me. Ever since that time, I keep my coat nicely buttoned. Use Lifebuoy every morning, kid. I use Band Ultra 5000. And incidentally, we got a question on line 3. Let's hear it. He's from outer space. All right, give me line 5.
Hello, Gene.
Yeah, hi. Wait a minute. Before you go, are you enjoying the show?
I like it very much.
Well, it's next to Hey, Barry. Yeah, how are you? Yeah, okay.
Okay. Would you like a pair of bunny slippers for Christmas?
Well, it depends. The last pair that I had mated. And had bunny slippers under the day bed for weeks. Okay, line 2. Line 2.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Hello?
Gene?
Yeah?
I'd like to know if you're going to sing...
No.
Bear.
No, not tonight. No. Aww. I only sing before an appreciative audience. I am not going to hurl pearls before swine. Well, I'd like to sing, but I, you know, actually when I sing the bear missed the train, I usually sing it in tights. And I will perform that, by the way, at my show at Carnegie Hall. It's going to be done fantastic. We've got the Russian ballet. We've got a real bear, and it's going to be done underwater. All right, let's hear it for the bear gang. Come on. We'll be back after this commercial.
Three identical pairs of glasses from 3 different opticians. One optician took 4 days to make them up. These took a week. And this pair, 1 hour at Vision Center. 1 hour. Because each Vision Center has its own lab, right on the premises. It's all here at Vision Center. The quality, the choice of frames and lenses, and complete 1 hour service.
Put on a happy face at your Vision Center.
presenting the Ethan Allen Home Fashion Sale, with substantial savings on exciting selections of living rooms, dining rooms, bedrooms, lamps, carpeting, draperies, and much more. And the same expert home planners who help you with your decorating problems all year round will be there to help you during the sale. At our Ethan Allen Home Fashion Sale, you may pay less, but you won't get less. Sale ends September 2nd. For the Ethan Allen Gallery nearest you, see the Yellow Pages.
Hello. You know, for several years I've been telling you about Hostess snack cakes and how much my children love them. Now Hostess has made something new for me. Although the kids enjoy them too. New Hostess crumb cakes. Light little cakes with a grown-up taste. Made with a flavorful cinnamon topping over delicious moist cake. Perfect for coffee time, breakfast, anytime. New Hostess crumb cakes. The light little cakes with a grown-up taste.
In two shakes and a squirt, Rethopine disinfectant spray helps stop household germs and odors before they can offend. Rethopine makes your world a nicer place to live.
Okay, this is for the audience out there. For tickets, if you'd like to come to the show, it's called The Talkers, and it's on five nights a week. Right, to The Talkers, that's the title of it, WPIX-TV, 220 East 42nd Street. And the zip is New York 10017. And you can start phoning Monday after 10 for tickets. And the number here is 883-5757. And by the way, if you'd like to order your storm doors within 20 minutes... All right, we've got more questions. Anybody? Yes, you. Call it out loud so we can all hear it.
I'd like to know what you fly and what you rate.
You would like to know what I fly. You're referring to legally. I fly an airplane. I fly several types. I fly Cessna 172s, 180s, 182s. Currently, I've been doing a lot of flying in a Grumman TR-1AA-1 trainer. And I'm doing a lot. I'm most of the way to my instrument rating. And I have I have a multi-engine rating. Okay? A very technical question, yeah.
Well, I know you said you had pets.
Well,
I mean, you know,
you're... Oh, I got some pets, baby. You ought to meet Esther Jane.
What other pets do you have?
What other pets do I have? Well, I have a very small, immature piranha.
What's his name?
His name is Clifford, actually. And I have, as far as pets are concerned with me, a pet. Now, I have a dachshund dog. And he's the only dog I know that eats day beds whole. I mean, this dog eats 5, 10, 15 pairs of slippers a week. And he's got a fantastic bladder capacity. Unbelievable. That dog will drink 2 pints of water, and the next thing you know, you got 17 gallons flowing all over. Just incredible dog. Huh? Do I treat my dog like a human? Are you kidding? Well, it depends on how you treat humans. I do kick them around a little bit, yeah. So, all right, line four, we got a question, yeah.
All right, Gene, when are you going to run for king again?
When am I going to do what?
Run for king again.
Run for king again. A king, by the way, is an esoteric television show that appears on PBS, and it's a show of retrospective chess players. Don't ask me what he's talking about. Line three.
Hi, Gene.
Hello.
How are you?
Well.
First of all, I think you're ex-qualificacious.
Okay, she's one of those. Yeah, all right.
No, I'm not. I want to know if a 66-year-old lady can marry and be very happy with a 78-year-old man, but immediately...
You better marry him immediately.
Why?
I mean, if not sooner, honey. Well, it depends on what makes you happy.
Well, for instance...
I know some people that like meatloaf sandwiches. Yeah, now what's your question?
That's the question.
Well, what do you think, crowd? Do you think she can marry a 78-year-old man and be happy? Let's put it to the crowd here.
He's got a nice insurance policy.
All you got to do is say, should she marry him? Raise your thumbs up if she shouldn't know. All right, let's hear it.
No!
Okay, next question, line three. That's a silly show here. Line three. You realize we're all grown-ups sitting here doing this? Yeah, line three. Hello.
We like it.
Hello, line two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hello, Gene?
Yeah.
Hello, Gene?
Yeah, hello, Fred.
Demonstrate your cute look for us.
Oh. He wants me to turn on my cute look.
No.
Would you like to see my cute... Oh, okay, buddy. All right, anybody else? Line five. By the way, that cute look got me through fifth grade. Yeah?
Hello, Gene.
Yes.
Hello, Gene.
Yeah, well, come on. Let's
okay, first I want to say I've been a great fan of yours for years.
Yeah.
Okay, number two.
I think you're great, too, Charlie. Yeah.
Thanks. Listen, I wonder if your mother ever found out about the peanut butter sandwiches behind the refrigerator.
Yeah, she did, as a matter of fact.
And what'd she do?
Not a thing. Being a good mother, when the plumber came... Well, I'll tell you what the story is. You know what he's talking about there. You know, all of us have a secret, terrible thing that we've done when we were kids that we really feel embarrassed about. And my mother got the idea that I liked tomato sandwiches with mayonnaise on. Well, you know, mothers get those ideas, you know. She had this idea that I liked them for lunch. And I'd take these things for lunch, and every day I would go, and instead of eating my lunch at school, I would go down to Red's candy store, and I would buy a Milky Way bar, eat the damn Milky Way bar. But because it was my mother, how many of you have ever had the feeling that any minute now your mother's going to die? Either that or you're going to die. You're not going to live to be 21. And if you do, you'll be blind. Then they'll be sorry, right? Well, I had this thing. I couldn't get myself to throw away these sandwiches, and I would bring them back home in this bag. My mother would be out of the kitchen, and I'd throw them back of the refrigerator. For 5 years, every day, I threw sandwiches back in the refrigerator. Oh, man, I'll tell you, we had roasted, we had mice. We had bison coming in eating. I mean, and one day I came home from school and the refrigerator was gone. My mother is in the living room and I knew the secret was out. It was like the time my dad went down in the basement to look for a tool to fix his tire. He went into the coal bin when I was away at school and found my collection of dirty books. He never told my mother, and I didn't know. One day I came down in the basement, and there's the old man reading them. At last we had something in common. But any other questions? Any of you got a call? What? How about line three?
It's Shepard?
Yes.
I'd say you got a fantastic show. I'd like to know, do you know how to play your head?
I do, but I can't tonight. Well, my head is a little out of condition. I keep my head soaked usually in neat split oil every night.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. I will play my head, though, at Carnegie Hall. Yeah, line two.
Gene?
Yeah.
I've been a friend of yours, a fan of yours for years, and I'd like you to say how your audiences have changed over the years.
Well, are you going to give me a lecture or are you going to talk to me? Now, you want me to say how they've changed?
Yes.
I don't think they have.
No particular way.
No, I think humor is something that's some people have, some haven't. And I think out of 25 people, probably three have a sense of humor. And those three have continued to be, you know, part of our audience, whether they're 10 years old or whether they're 5 years old or whether they're 100. And I think that it just remains like that. Have you had a good time, gang? Come on, let's hear it. And listen, I want to tell you, I'm going to be at Carnegie Hall Saturday night, September 14th, and I want to see all you there. Because I can take it all off that night. What was that? What's a cow swing? Oh, no, I'm not Johnny Carson. Shepard may show you how he throws cow flaps. Golf swing, Johnny Carson. All right, gang, I hope, yeah. Question. Do I smoke? Is that a loaded question? Well, I like to smoke a cheap cigar now and again, especially the kind that comes that in a cellophane wrapper. It says it's a boy on the side. Yeah, the big twisted one. Yeah, the souvenir 42nd Street. All right, we've got one more minute. Anybody else here? Yeah. Well, my brother Randy is 6'3" and is doing very well. Yeah. How do I do what? I just think of them in my head. That's the way you have to do it, you know. You gotta. How do you think up stories, the kid asks. Well, I use a Ouija board. Hey, you know, it's been a lot of fun, hasn't it, gang? Yeah, anybody else here? Come on. Or for, yeah. Well, thank you to Ireland and so on. I'm glad you enjoy that. Anybody else here? One more. Yeah.
I do indeed.
This week, TV Guide brings together three Miss Americas to discuss the influence the Crown had on their careers. TV Guide.
I needed a $1,700 loan in a day. I got it at Chase. Like they say, whatever you do for a living, you have a friend at Chase Manhattan.
Alan Burke is back, and he's lighting some real fires for frustrated New Yorkers. See him this Monday night at 10:30 following Action News.
Television in New York City, August 30th, 1974. Gene Shepherd starring in The Talkers. Lost. Gene Shepherd. Speaking of Lost, we're going to round out the program now with two ends of programs. So these probably aren't circulating because, you know, people don't generally latch on to partial shows, but we have two of them for you. This from sometime in April. Middle of April, 1970. I called it The Politics of Style. It's the end of the program. Gene Shepherd.
A few years ago, when the guys who drove big, fat, four-door cars with fins all over them, they would get very mad when they would see a guy with a little car on the street. Oh, yeah, they'd... Oh, what do you think, you communist? What do you think you are, huh, Marlon Brando? Well, this happened to me many times. I was one of the first guys that owned an MG. I owned an MG in the late... Well, actually, when I got out of the Army, I bought an MG. And I discovered very rapidly that it was not a car I was buying. It was an ideology. That every time I drive down the street, guys would holler, "Who do you think? Hey, look, hey, Manny, hey, what are you? Oh, hey, well, you fag? Oh, oh," you know, they yell out the door. Yeah, but so, sure, this is very. So you find that people tend to blame changes. In other words, what they were seeing on the street was a change, and the change went against everything that they held true and proper. In short, the guy of that period thought that the best car was the biggest car. You remember that period when everyone used to say, "Oh, he's really got a big car, man." The idea of a big car was related to a good car. Anything that was big was good. And that was a certain period. Well, he saw a little car driving down the street, and that was a direct rebuke to his concept of a big car. So instead of just simply saying, "Well, that guy likes a little car, I like a big car," no, he said, "That guy obviously is sick. There's some kind of scene going on here, and it's a plot, see, because he saw other little cars around, and he kept seeing hints that the little car may be pretty damn good, you know, ranging all the way from the Ferrari, you know, down to the Maserati," and he just confused him. So that tendency to blame stylistic changes, now I'm getting into some style idea here, the tendency to blame stylistic changes on a political plot by the other side is very common. And it's a natural thing to do, but that doesn't make it, you know, valid. It doesn't really make it valid at all. And so the idea of the right wing believing that long hair is a left-wing plot is as equally ridiculous as, say, Gloria Steinem believing that midi skirts are a right-wing plot. They're both equally, you know, they're both on shaky grounds. And yet there are those who believe these things strongly. Yet I say this, that what we tend to do, too, is laugh at the other guy's argument and think of ours as valid. In short, I'm sure that the left, who are now defending the miniskirt, would think of the right defending the crew cut as ridiculous, as paranoid, you see. And I say that no, that style has very little to do, really, ultimately, in spite of, I know a lot of sociologists write long, learned things about it, but I think that's often just coincidental. And I think that evil is in the eyes of the beholder, just the way beauty is. That we tend to create fantastic, great, overwhelming theories to, in a sense, rationalize our own problems. And so you're going to hear a lot of these gloppy theories around. It's going to be all kinds of theories now. And as we get more self-conscious, you're going to hear more theories. But nobody, it's like Freud, you know, comment I've ever heard on that idea of over-analyzing and becoming so self-conscious that everything has meaning. You know, there's a lot of people who really live that way, that everything they see, every little ad has phallic meanings, Paul Krasner's like this. Everything he sees has all kinds of deep, hidden pornographic meanings. And this gets to the point of almost like counting the number of angels that are dancing on the head of a pin, you see. And so it ultimately becomes a very definite truism that pornography is in the eyes of the beholder, just the way the beauty is. So a guy who's looking for pornography in ads is the same guy who will laugh at the people who see pornography in, let's say, Swedish films. But he thinks he's right, though, you see, because he thinks he's proving the other guy is being wrong. But nevertheless, Freud once came to, of course, it's a very famous story among psychologists, but it is true. Maybe you haven't heard it. But the point that he was making was very well taken and is even more relevant today than ever. Freud was attending a big meeting of psychologists from the new field of psychology, come from all over the world, and he came into the meeting, and Freud was smoking a cigar. Well, immediately they all looked up, saying, Freud's got the cigar. And he says, before anyone could say anything, he says, gentlemen, let us also remember, it is a damn good cigar. Now, that's a good point, you see, that style could very well be a desire for simple physical appearance change. That style is always that. People have a great hunger for change. I don't care who you are. You do, Matt. Everybody does. You have a desire to change. The change is a thing that, and on the other hand, you tend to resent change, curiously enough. It's a love-hate relationship. So on the one hand, you want change, but on the other hand, you want change that is, in a sense, how can I put it, that is simpatico with you. And so if you happen to look fantastic in, let's say, gray flannel suits, just personally, that's your complexion, everything else about you, see, makes it good in gray flannel suits. You are going to tend to resent a sudden new style, which, say, goes for green gabardine shorts. You know, you're going to say, well, what is this, you know? What are they trying to do? Well, instead of being, and honesty is a rare quality. Instead of being totally honest and say, well, the reason I'm against this style is that I look lousy in green. No, you tend to say, well, of course, that's that ridiculous fashion industry. What they're trying to do is foist off this ridiculous fashion on us. And not only that, I think it's a right-wing plot. Well, I'm sure that if Gloria Steinem didn't look good in a miniskirt, she would not relate the change from miniskirts to a right-wing plot. I'm just laying that premise out there. That if Gloria, let's say, weighed 190 pounds and was 4 feet 3 inches tall, I doubt very much, and with the same mind, you see, the same brain and everything, I doubt whether she would find the change from the mini to the midi a right-wing subversive plot that somehow is related to Spiro Agnew and Trisha Nixon. But, because we can't stop being personal. We can't stop being the individual. I'm not putting Gloria down for that. I'm just saying that we can't stop being that way. And by the way, I've known her for a long time, so there's no personal animosity here. I just think, though, that from time to time, we tend to believe a theory that augments our own sense of righteousness. And we tend to, in a sense, reject out of hand a theory, but it may be the same theory if it's given by the wrong people. Now, if William Buckley were to write a very long, involved piece, and highly stylistic and funny, he can do that, that proves that long hair and bell-bottom pants are a left-wing plot, this would be a joke. People would laugh at it. Because you don't buy Buckley. You don't buy the right, you see. So the plot then, the theory is no good. Now, if it is written by somebody you like, let's take Norman Mailer. If Norman Mailer were to write something which is no better stylistically and certainly less funny, he doesn't have much sense of humor, to prove that the decline of the miniskirt is a right-wing plot, you'd tend to applaud it. And so, in short, though, we don't really listen to ideas. We listen to who gives the idea. That's what's important. And whether or not it is on our side, that's a good idea. If it's on the other guy, for example, if a black man speaks separatism, he will be applauded by a lot of people. If a black man speaks in favor of, let's say, violence, he will be applauded by a lot of people. The same people would condemn segregation if a white man spoke it, which is the same thing. That's separatism, you know. So ultimately, we tend to be very subjective about our attitudes towards theories and about what's said and what isn't said and so forth, until ultimately most of this stuff is pure hogwash, really. And so the idea, my feeling is, the idea of attempting to relate fashions to political attitudes is really reaching, because you're overlooking one important human characteristic, and that is, no matter whether you're right or left or in between, you're always looking for something to make you look better. And if you seriously believe that a certain fashion will make you look better, you don't care what ideology it represents, because it really doesn't represent anything, any ideology at all. And so you can go back by selective, and this is what most people do, by selective combing of history, you can prove any theory if you ignore large other areas. So if you can prove that short skirts go with left-wing thinking, right? And this is really what, in a sense, Glory was saying. If that's the case, then why was it that America, when it was at a very short skirt, the 20s were the shortest, this side of the miniskirt, the 20s historically had the shortest skirts of any time in American history. And that was a very right-wing, a very pro-conservative period. Cal Coolidge was in the White House. Now, in the 30s, oddly enough, when there was a lot of left-wing thinking that became very popular in the 30s, this became a big deal historically, the skirts were at one of their longest periods since the time of prior to World War I. The long skirts, you see them on the old movies. So the idea of attempting to, you're on pretty shaky grounds when you say that modesty has to do with attitudes, pro and con, short skirts and so on, that many of the most politically conservative attitudes were often related to great skin flicks. A good example of that was in Hitler's Germany. This was a time when attention was paid to personal modesty, but at the same time, there was a lot of fantastic orgiastic goings-on that went on in that period, as witness, if you're curious, as witness Christopher Isherwood's report in I Am a Camera. So, you know, you're on one man's soup is another man's gravy. And, you know, one man's concept is another man's idiotic, nutty hang-up. And so which way, what it is, I don't know. But I can say this, getting back to the original premise, I can never escape getting excited over receiving in the mail an Allied or a Lafayette catalog. You didn't think I'd get back to it. Which means, but I don't put that down as any right-wing or left-wing plot. I simply say that's me. And that came out of the fact that once when I was about 12 years old, I sent away to the Allied catalog people for this catalog. I read an ad for it. And I waited about 3 or 4 weeks to get this thing, and I got more excited every day, you see. It was like building up this tremendous moment of drama, and it never arrived. And then 3 weeks later, in the mail, came the Allied catalog, and it was like the culmination of a fantastic, dramatic moment. And it was exciting. I opened the Allied catalog, it was big, fat, you know, and had all this great radio parts in it, and I was studying to be a ham, and it sort of embodied my whole life at that point. And so ever since that time, Allied catalogs have been exciting to me, period. Nothing to do with psychological and or sexual and or psychotic hang-ups. It was the moment of time. Now, if you at one point, and this is not true necessarily of New Yorkers, if you aimed your whole life when you were at a very formative stage, let's say 15, at getting a car, cars will forever, from that moment on, be exciting to you, no matter what happens. Do you agree with that, Matt? Even when you get to be 100. Now, if you spent all of your time at the age of 12 scheming to get a girl, from that time on, forever, you're going to write nothing but erotic novels, plays, dramas, and all that stuff, especially if it didn't happen. Because writing tends to be a fantasy wish fulfillment. And, you tend to fill out in your writing or your drama what never happened in life to you. And so many writers, by the way, present themselves in their novels. The I, you know, the one guy that represents the writer, he's tough, man, and he's fantastically successful with women. You see this in Mailer's work. And, man, he's a fist-fighting so-and-so. And so We tend to wish fulfill that way, but in the case of a catalog, this too can do the same thing. And so, if at one point you're fascinated by cars, you will always be excited by car magazines. If you're if at one point your whole desire at the age of 12 was to become a licensed amateur radio operator, and you spent 2 years studying and struggling to get it, that this catalog represents a fantastic moment in your life, which you'll never, ever outgrow. You will never outgrow it. Forget it. You won't outgrow it. Oh, man, look at that big, fat Allied catalog. Ain't that beautiful, I'll tell you. Now, of course, you don't warm to it. I agree you don't. But then again, I'm sure that I don't agree. I don't warm to the very thing that puts you out in order, you know, outer orbit. And so, you know, six of one, half dozen of the other. In fact, I never get excited over fashions, whereas most New York people do, because they're related around this whole thing. And so you'll find thousands of New Yorkers will be spending their time over at Barney's, you know, looking at the latest men's clothes. It's very exciting to them. That doesn't excite a guy from Indianapolis. On the other hand, he'll get excited over a Manny Mullen Jack automobile parts catalog. Which is better? Well, just different, you know.
From mid-April 1970, an end of a Gene Shepherd program from the Dick the Phone collection. And at the end of our next fragment, we're going to hear why it's called the Dictaphone Collection. Before, I don't know if he recorded over a part of the show and then held on to the news from the end, but apparently from March 30th, a Saturday, 1968, the old man in the six-foot kite, the last 11 minutes or so, to wrap up today's Dustbin of History on WBAI New York.
Each other as they go, they began to create myths. And those are the most interesting of all creations.
myth. In fact, but then again, there has been a rumor that my name is Hickey. It ain't really. By the way, why don't you go out and try it? I mean, you've all been saying that you're going to write a novel. Going to go out and get a date with Susan Sontag. Or you're going to call Marsha McLuhan on the phone. Or you're going to touch the left rear fender of John Lennon's Rolls Royce. I mean, you know, I'm not going to put your ambitions down. I mean, because after all, is it right from one butterfly to complain about the other butterfly's slow rolls? Not at all. We do not all have the same amount of talent. And that is a fact. Some butterflies can fly better than others. Have you ever watched a flock of geese? Well, you know, when you watch a flock of geese, it's probably, to the untutored eye, it seems to be obvious that all geese can fly as well as all other geese. Don't kid yourself. In fact, I saw a seagull one time spend 15 minutes trying to take off downwind. A real bad, untalented seagull. You know, all I could do to keep myself from running out and say, look, why don't you try it upwind once and correct for the cross current there and get a good run and watch out for your stalling speed because he kept stalling out. But then again, you know, who am I? Because when all is said and done, I'm probably not a very talented seagull myself. You know, a 220 hitter does not get off easy telling Roger Maris that he ought to do something about his grip. I mean, you can try. Maris would probably laugh. But then maybe not. Because he worries too. I mean, being human, which is the problem that we all have to face. And as you go walking along there, that great yellow brick road, wearing your Tom McCann's, and has it occurred to you that the Tom McCann makes a shoe especially for butterflies? Makes even the pavement seem soft, they say. Well, after all, there's nothing worse than a footsore walking butterfly. And then, you know, if you walk long enough, you develop bunions on your sole. And after that, not much you can do except just sit there and hope that one day Broadway will wake up and they'll start putting on real life so that you don't have to worry about real life anymore. You can go to the show and there it'll be. And so the old man started to build that kite. And he worked on it. I would go down to the basement because it was laying on the basement floor next to the coal bin. My kid brother was about a foot and a half tall at that time. His nose ran a lot. He used to run down on his kid tennis shoes. He whined. He was always slightly behind me and to my stern quarter, whining. And we watched the kite being built. And then one spring day, in very early April, because that's when spring comes out of the north, comes blowing down over the Sault Ste. Marie and past Beaver Island, comes screaming down out of the lake, and the next thing you know, the ice breaks up and everybody gets the itch. Fights break out on the south side. The flag starts standing hard and tall. And the windows shine in the sun. And three airplanes crash at O'Hare. You know it's the spring. Well, they do that because the spring makes the air kind of skittish. You never know when you're going to drag a wingtip. You never know, friends. And so the spring comes roaring down like some great breath of an ancient memory that you'd like to see come back, and yet you're afraid that it's here again. But then April is not necessarily the coolest month. I guess what it really means, that slogan, is that people get themselves cruelest in April. April is just another month. And so the old man goes down in the basement and starts getting that kite out. And it was Saturday morning, because that was the only time the old man ever did stuff like that. And he took the kite out into the backyard and put it on the roof of the Oldsmobile with a great big ball of twine about 7 miles long. And we drove out to a big vacant lot. And he took the kite off the top of the Oldsmobile, Schwartz and Flick and Bruner and all the kids. There must have been 500 of them gathered around to see the big kite take off. And the old man started running over the field, trying to get that kite up in the air. I don't know whether you ever tried to take a 6-foot kite off the ground. It takes a lot of running. It takes a lot of wind, and the old man didn't have either. So he ran back and forth up and down that field, dragging a kite in the weeds and the stickers, until the tail had nothing but hackles and burrs and stuff sticking all over it. And he swore. Swearing is a purgative. In fact, there has been a rumor around that swearing is the detergent of mankind. And you notice that detergent never dissolves. It floats on the river all the time. They had it 4,000 years ago. Swearing. It was one of the first words ever invented. It was a swear word. In fact, we don't really know the first word that man exchanged with his fellow man. But I have a suspicion. That could have been it, too. I'm not going to carry that too far, because it's late and there are kids up. But they know, too, because they're part of mankind, you know. They're not a separate nationality, in spite of what Dr. Spock thinks. Or wants to dream. Did I see a terrible piece of graffiti down in the village? Inside one of those metal phone booths. Dr. Spock. Oh, we don't want to carry that out. That's just, you just pick these up. I saw another awful one that said, Hugh Hefner is a member of the Rotary Club. I think that's dirty. I mean, you can say a lot of things, but some things you just shouldn't say. So the old man goes tearing across the field trying to get that kite up. And he never got it up that Saturday. All week went by, and the next Saturday came up, and man, there was a spanking wind coming out of the north, a cool, brisk, spanking wind being brought on the blue, silver, magnificent, soft pushings of another late spring day. The old man put that kite on top of the olds, and we went out to the vacant field again, surrounded by a coterie of kids, each one, by the way, about to get his wings burned off just a little bit. And not knowing it. Well, the old man ran across the field the first time, and that kite went up about 30, 40 feet. And it came down. He tried it again, and that kite climbed higher. The third time, that kite started to lift, and the wind got it. She got caught by an updraft in a thermal. That kite went higher and higher and higher. I will never forget the shout that went up. And that cord began to pay out. More and more and more. The old man's eyes are shining like two tromped-on toad frogs. Higher and higher that kite went. Let me tell you, have you ever seen a kite a half a mile up in the air with the wind blowing and the sun flashing on those Chicago Tribune editorial pages? But that kite kept pulling and pulling. The old man's struggling until all of a sudden he's at the end of the cord. That kite was climbing. And he couldn't hold it. That cord busted. And there was a shout and a roar, and that kite went drifting off toward the south, laying about a half a mile above the surface of the earth. He made a wild grab at the stump of the string. It went drifting over some barbed wire fences and was gone. Never saw that kite again. The kids cheered and hollered, and the old man never built another kite, at least 6 feet tall. So you got to be careful on these spring days. Love to do something that's going to get you into trouble and that you'll never forget. Burn little edges off the wings. But you know, I've come to the conclusion that that's the only good wings in the ultimate sense are for. To be burned off. Nothing is sadder than to see a butterfly laid away for his final rest with a full set of wings. He never even discovered that there was a plane. Poor fool. Let's go to Babylon.
From March 30th, 1968, now you know why I called it the Dictaphone Collection.
Well, no, you don't, because I had to cut all that for time to finish on time. I also realized it was WPIX-TV that the talkers was from. So, Barry, you can withhold your brickbats. You have no idea what kind of a rush I'm in producing this program.
They were sent to me on, what, 3-inch tapes, 5-inch tapes? Don't even remember who Dictaphone might have been. But that's it. 3 fragments of Lost Gene Shepherd for you on tonight's Dustbin. And if you would like to know more about the program, you can visit our Facebook page called The Dustbin of History. Right there on Facebook, you can join it, follow it, like it, love it, The Dustbin of History on Facebook. And next week, who knows what we'll be doing, probably delving into some of these untapped resources of lost material, since every time I try to come up with something topical and to, in this season, turns out someone beat me to it, posting it to Facebook or Archive or Figgly Gee or whatever.